Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Pete Seneschal, appearing on behalf of Corvette Williams. I'd like to focus my presentation this morning on Mr. Williams' ineffective assistance of counsel claim. When counsel received the letter from Mr. Williams, he had a number of permissible options, courses of action that he could have taken. He could have gone down and spoken to Mr. Williams and attempted to assess his intentions with respect to the letter. He could have tried to dissuade him.
I find these arguments unattractive. The lawyer has detected the person attempting a crime, right?
Well, that's not clear from the record, Your Honor.
It's clear, yeah.
The lawyer received a letter from his client, and all he had was speculation that there was anything afoot. The rules of professional conduct and the Sixth Amendment require an attorney to take remedial measures before he voluntarily reveals confidential information about his client.
But why was Ryan under any duty to keep the contents of the letter confidential, given that Mr. Williams wasn't seeking out legal advice from Ryan? In fact, he was really just using his attorney as a convenient way to circumvent any inspection of the letter by authorities.
Well, Your Honor, there's several issues here with regard to your question. First of all is that regardless of the confidential nature of the information was known only to Mr. Ryan. And the duty of loyalty, which the Supreme Court recognized in Strickland versus Washington, is one of the basic duties inherent in the Sixth Amendment right to counsel.
And well, so what if instead of giving him this letter, he'd given him an envelope, and he says, in this envelope is poison. I'd like you to give this to the government's principal witness. It'll kill him, and then I'll be acquitted. Now, what should the lawyer do in that case? He counsel his client that is not a nice thing to do? Could get you in trouble? So I'm going to confiscate your poison? Is that a proper response?
Well, Your Honor, that's...
Is that a proper response, yes or no?
Yes, that is a proper response. Although if the lawyer...
Well, I'm sorry, you've lost me.
Your Honor, the critical inquiry there is whether the lawyer has a reasonable belief that there is a crime imminent.
That's an if in my example. That's an open question, the example I gave you. He gives him the poison. He says, I want you to give it to the government's witness and kill him. And you say the lawyer is supposed to say, well, if this is criminal, then I don't know, maybe I have to counsel you not to do it. Is that? You really think that's the duty of loyalty?
Your Honor, in acknowledging...
Do you think that is the duty?
No, obviously, if the lawyer believes that the client intends to kill somebody or, you know, inflict serious bodily harm on somebody, the rules of professional...
What should he do in that case?
Well, first of all, he needs to ensure that his belief that crime is...
What should he do if he believes... You mean he has to conduct an investigation? This is poison. I want you to kill the government's witness. So you're saying the lawyer has to conduct an investigation?
Your Honor, the Supreme Court has said that.
Is that what? Just
no.
Answer
the lawyer,
me
if the
yes
lawyer
no.
knows that the client intends to commit a crime of violence,
okay, what should the lawyer do?
He can reveal the information.
Okay.
But that's a different situation than we have here. In this case,
both cases, you're breaking the law, are you not?
Yeah.
You are breaking the law, but this. This attorney is...
So it's a matter of degree of how much you're breaking the law?
Well, the difference is whether or not the crime is going to occur or has occurred in the past. In this situation, all the lawyer has is a letter from his client, which hasn't gone any further than the attorney. He kept the letter, and he had no reasonable belief that...
It's an attempt to suborn perjury.
Certainly.
That's a crime.
But a lawyer has a duty not to reveal that information about his client.
He has a duty to reveal the attempted murder, but he doesn't have a duty to reveal attempted suborning perjury. That's your position.
That is our position, Your Honor. In the rules of professional...
So what do we have? We have a hierarchy of crimes, and at some point your client has taken a step up the ladder, and now your duty is not to protect him but to turn him in. That's your position?
The lawyer is permitted...
Is that your position?
Yes, the lawyer is permitted to reveal information about the client in certain specific circumstances, and the courts have recognized that.
Not certain specific. You have in your mind, you have some list of crimes of increasing gravity, and at some point you say there's a flip, and the lawyer is no longer have a duty of loyalty. Yes, he should turn the person in.
That is true, Your Honor. The rules of professional conduct make specific provision.
Do the rules say that? You know, there's this ladder, and it's a really bad crime, you turn him in. If it's what's suborning perjury, it goes on all the time in courts. So there the duty of loyalty remains. That's in these professional codes, are you saying?
Yeah. Yes. And the point of it is that
how do they define the distinction?
The duty of loyalty is the overarching duty that a lawyer owes to his client.
How do they define the exceptions?
The exceptions are that a
poison case. What exception embraces that?
The rule 1.6b allows a lawyer to reveal information that he knows about his client to the extent it's necessary to prevent a crime that will involve bodily harm or death.
Mr. Seneschal, one of my concerns in this case is that in ways that seem highly relevant here, the rules of conduct that govern in the Northern District of Illinois have changed over the relevant period of time. And as I understand this, your position might be considerably stronger if the same situation were to happen today. But at the time that this happened, the relevant rule, the version of 1.6 in effect here, said a lawyer may use or reveal the intention of a client to commit a crime. Period. Well, there's an exception, but without setting up this hierarchy, without limiting it to imminent death or bodily harm or financial harm.
Sure, Your Honor, but the difference is that in addition to that, to the rule of confidentiality, the lawyer has an overarching duty to protect information about the client and not use that information to
disclose. Overarching, because there are exceptions.
If 1.6 is telling the lawyer you can reveal the intention of a client to commit a crime, does some other rule say you cannot?
Your Honor, I have to say I'm not familiar with the change in the rule. My understanding is that the Northern District of Illinois adopted the ABA model rules of professional conduct.
Well, we've tried to reconstruct what the rules were in effect at the time that Attorney Ryan faced this dilemma. And those, I believe, are the terms. A lawyer may use or reveal the intention of a client to commit a crime in circumstances other than those enumerated actually in Rule 1.6b.
Well, even under Your Honor's example, the counsel was not revealing the intention to commit a crime. He was revealing his client's conduct. As far as the lawyer knew, there was no possible action beyond the letter. He did nothing to communicate with his client to confirm whether or not the client intended to commit this act beyond the letter.
I agree that's a problem. On the other hand, there's a problem with if the lawyer just goes and talks to his client and says, I'm not going to do this, then there's probably a pretty foreseeable risk that he's going to ask somebody else who visits him in jail to communicate this same request to his cousin Brookins, even if it has to be done orally, a little less reliably, without all the details that he wanted to get across in his letter to Brookins.
But that's a critical difference here, is that at least in your hypothetical, the lawyer has made some effort to verify his speculation about what's going to happen. And in Nix versus Whiteside, the Supreme Court specifically said that an attorney's first duty when confronted with what he thinks is a attempt to commit perjury or some sort of misconduct is to go talk to the client and attempt to dissuade him from the conduct.
Can I ask you just one follow-up question then? which is if you could tell me about what you think the standard of review is that applies here, because this terrible problem of ineffective assistance of counsel appears not to have arisen in two trials and one prior appeal.
Your Honor, the standard review here is de novo because this is a constitutional claim about our client.
Plain error doesn't come into play?
The government has taken the position that trial counsel needed to object to the admission of the evidence in order to preserve the error for appeal. First of all, the government has failed to raise the specific argument of waiver, so they've waived that argument. But the main issue, our claim here is that regardless of whether the evidence should have been objected to or not, under the Strickland test, a client does not receive a fair trial if, but for his counsel's errors, there's a reasonable likelihood of a different result at trial.
What's the reasonable likelihood of a different result?
Well, in this case, counsel's testimony was critical to the government's case, and had it not been created...
Have other evidence?
Excuse me?
There was no other evidence?
There was other evidence, Your Honor, but when the court looks at whether or not the criminal defendant in an ineffective assistance case has established prejudice, they are supposed to weigh the evidence along in totality of the circumstances. So in this case, the way the government used counsel's testimony was essential to its case. And
it was essential? Why?
We point out in our brief that the government, although the government argues that their case was overwhelming, they had overwhelming evidence, they had an ethical obligation not to call counsel as a witness.
That's a separate issue. The question is, if you subtract the lawyer's evidence, isn't the remaining evidence overwhelming?
No, Your Honor.
What's
The only evidence, the government had no direct evidence that Mr. Williams was involved in this crime. They had two witnesses that testified that they knew he was involved. But the first witness was an immunized government informant. And Mr. Williams' ex-girlfriend, who identified him on the surveillance video, could only identify him based on his movements. The robbers
well,
in these...
What about the money? The money in the car?
The money in the car was not found on Mr. Williams. It was found in his girlfriend's possession.
Well, but the girlfriend wasn't the bank robber. I don't understand.
I thought your point was, yes, there's sufficient evidence to convict, but the government highlighted in opening and closing and finished its case with Ryan's testimony.
That is our position, Your Honor, but our position is also that even if you subtracted counsel's testimony, that there's a reasonable likelihood of a different result at trial, and that's what Strickland requires.
I don't understand. What's your theory as to how that money got into the car where he is driven by his girlfriend?
Your Honor, I don't have a theory about how it got there.
It's rather a weakness, isn't it? I don't see how a jury could have acquitted him.
Well, but the point is, looking at all the evidence that was used at trial, the government decided to use...
Yes, I know that. That's Judge Hamilton's point. It's correct. They harped on it. It was juicy. But the standard is, might a reasonable jury have acquitted if that error hadn't been committed, if it was an error? I don't see this.
Well, our position is that there's a reasonable probability, Your Honor.
Okay. Well... Okay, thank you, Mr. Seneschal. Mr. Buckman?
Mr. Nash. Michael Nash for the defendant, Brian Austin. First of all, Judge, as you are undoubtedly aware, the defendant has filed a supplemental brief raising a point. The government's in its response... attempts, it seems to me, to cast it as a ineffective assistance of counsel argument. Obviously aware of this court's disdain for those arguments.
There's something odd about the about your challenges to the sentences, because you complain that you say. It's a joint brief, so I don't mean you personally. But on page 48 of your brief, you say, the district judge imposed identical increases on the defendants, despite their unique characteristics. But there's nothing in maybe it's a joint brief. It doesn't actually argue for any differences between the defendants that would affect their sentences.
I think there would have been differences. I'm not as familiar with those that issue as Mr. Seneschal would be.
Okay, well, we don't have to say anything.
I don't mean to pass it off, okay. But that's the way we divided the labor. As I started to say, the government attempts to cast the supplemental brief as an argument for ineffective assistance of counsel. I don't think that that's correct. The opening line of the defendant's supplemental brief is, my argument is the district court abused its discretion by failing to inquire into an apparent attorney-client conflict. The closing line on that first page of the supplemental brief is, I was prejudiced by the district court's failure to inquire. I think I misspoke myself. That's in the a letter addressed to the clerk, which is, I believe, part and parcel of his brief. And so I wouldn't want this court to rule that ineffective assistance to counsel did not exist here or that the issue was raised. As to the argument made by me, Judge, it's often the case here that we cite cases and we discuss cases. My argument regarding Mr. Austin is very simple. It is impossible for a jury to reasonably conclude that somebody could identify the man in this picture. There are four pictures out of the seven or eight that were introduced into evidence on which she said she based her identification. That is patently unreasonable. And given the fact that the only other real evidence against Mr. Austin was basically the very late arrival of a informant, the co-defendant, who paid no price for his testimony. He received complete immunity from all his federal crimes and help by the federal government in his state court case. He was a multiple felon, not that that plays upon the court, but this case, this evidence was insufficient on its face to convict him. Could a jury? Sure, they did. Could they? This was a terrible crime. Two banks were robbed at gunpoint. People were put in danger of losing their life. There was a lot of emotion in this case. But to say that somebody can identify the person in this picture is patently unreasonable, and this verdict should not stand.
Why isn't Walker's testimony, is that the name?
That's the name.
Yeah, why isn't his testimony enough to at least satisfy the Jackson against Virginia standard? Any reasonable jury might, if it's credited, convict on that.
I can't say that it is not definitively enough, Judge, because juries can find what they want. But when you couple his testimony, which was at the very last minute, with no cost to himself, and you support it with this, then it's not enough.
I understand. Well, I understand the jury argument, but when a jury is hearing from somebody saying, "Yeah, I was there, I did this," they're not allowed to believe that?
They are. They can believe what they want. But in this case, I think that it was highly suspect. We know that all the cases that come before this court that later end up after 5 or 10 years with some recantation or DNA, they come from false identification and jailhouse informants. That's what this is. This is a ticket to one of those impossible, regretful situations. And in this case, the mere fact that the government thought it necessary to rely on this identification to convict. And remember that except for the last minute coming of wisdom to Mr. Walker, the government would have gone to trial
well,
with...
It was also, of course, his barbershop alibi certainly collapsed.
It did, Judge, although when you read the testimony... it collapses as to time and the impulse with which he made it. It comes from he finds out what he's arrested for. No, I was at the barber shop. Did he make a mistake? From the basis of this transcript, certainly he did. Did he make a mistake worth 686 months in penitentiary? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. If the court has no...
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Buckman. Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Nash.
I'm sorry. What am I doing?
That handsome guy's Mr. Nash.
Thank you, sir.
That handsome guy's Mr. Buckman.
You mean I'm so you're Mr. Seneschal and he's Mr. Buckman?
No. That handsome guy's Mr. Seneschal.
Well, now I'm low.
If I can't convince the court who I am, I don't have much chance.
And were you wearing a mask?
Who are you?
Thank you.
Who are these people? That's Mr. Seneschal. That's Mr. Nash, and that's Mr. Buckman.
Oh, you're Mr. Nash. I'm sorry.
He was when he came in. I don't know who he is now.
That's okay. I was misled. I'm sorry. Okay. Are you Mr. Peterson?
Yes, I am.
Are you sure?
Yes, I am. Okay. May it please the court. We're asking that the court affirm the convictions and sentences of both defendants. I'd first like to address the ineffective assistance of counsel argument, and we agree that the standard should be plain error, that in order for defendant to prevail on this, he needed to allege also that his trial counsel was ineffective as well, which he concedes that the record is insufficiently developed at this point to make that argument.
I have a question that I'm just longing to ask, so I will. I'd like you to respond to that argument that the government had an ethical obligation not to call Mr. Williams' former attorney as a witness against him unless the attorney's testimony was necessary to obtain a conviction. And, you know, they cited that ABA model rule.
Well, we believe our harmless error argument is not inconsistent with...
No, your harmless error argument is all right, but it's not. It wasn't a nice thing to do. I mean, you have plenty of evidence. You didn't need to. Because to have the fellow's lawyer testify against him, that's devastating, really.
Well,
it's just so unnecessary. I don't know. It's piling on. There wasn't any doubt about William's guilt, so...
Well, in hindsight, we can say that, Your Honor, but our understanding of what essential to the successful prosecution means is that it is not cumulative or peripheral. It directly relates to an issue at trial, and in this case, the identity of Austin and Williams was a key issue, actually probably the only issue at trial, since the robbers were both masked when they went into the banks. And the evidence that we presented regarding him attempting to obtain a false alibi.
It's not as if the alibi was presented and then you wanted to show it was false. That would be, there was no, he didn't present the alibi, did he?
No, he did not.
Yeah, so I mean, that would have been the obviously appropriate use of the lawyer's testimony to demolish his alibi.
Well, our understanding of Rule 3.8e, in looking at the only commentary, it's intended to limit the issuance of lawyers' opinions.
And probative. You can imagine someone who's innocent but who says, oh, I'm going to be convicted anyway, so I need an alibi, right? That would be a separate crime. Wouldn't show necessarily that he was guilty of the crime he was charged with. There are errors, after all.
Was Rule 3.8e even adopted by the Northern District of Illinois at the time this occurred?
I'm not sure whether or not.
Has anybody checked to see what the rules were back when Ryan faced this problem and when you did the trial?
I looked at the Illinois model rules. I did not look at the rules. I admit that I did not look at
rules. This is directed at both sides, but I mean, the Northern District of Illinois adopted rules and it made changes. Some of them are critical to this case. And you can't simply cite what the ABA's model is. If what Mr. Ryan faced was binding professional rules adopted by the court in which he was practicing, those are the rules to check, not the ABA model rules.
I can't answer that question. I do know that as far as 3.8E, Illinois had adopted that rule at the time of the trial as to the duties to prosecutors, and we believe that we followed the rule.
The second trial.
Correct, at the time of the second trial. And he had already testified once at the first trial with no objection and no challenge on appeal. So we take issue with the defendant's characterization that essential means necessary for conviction.
Could I go back to the standard of review for a second, Mr. Peterson? I understand you to be saying, in essence, you don't think we should reach the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel in this case because the record is not complete. And if that's right, then we or another panel of this court, if we otherwise affirm convictions here, will be hearing these same arguments a year or two from now. Is that what you think would be appropriate?
I'm saying that plain error applies as far as standard of review.
Well,
but
that's...
I'm saying...
The consequence of that position seems to be that we don't reach the ineffective assistance of counsel claim because it's incomplete here, and we push that back for a 2255 proceeding that will take another several years, and if it's successful, would result in a third trial how many years after the original robberies? Maybe 10 years after those robberies?
Possibly. Our argument as to not raising the trial counsel's ineffective assistance goes to whether or not they can establish prejudice for this claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. If what they're arguing, which we disagree with, but in order for them to show prejudice from the pretrial disclosure of the letter, they have to show that that was the but-for cause of the evidence being admitted against Williams. But there were other attorneys that were appointed to represent Mr. Williams at the first trial on appeal and the second trial. No one raised this issue. That evidence could have been prevented from being presented to the jury.
Did you argue harmless error?
Pardon me?
Did you argue harmless error?
Yes, we did, Your Honor.
I guess I still have trouble understanding your answer to Judge Rovner's question. If 3.E is in place at the time of the second trial, you've got this obligation, only if necessary. You emphasize this point in your opening and your closing. You finish off the case with the effort to suborn perjury through the attorney, having in essence turned Ryan, although he turned himself, in essence, from the defense to the prosecution. You've got a good case without that, but doesn't that strengthen your case substantially? Wasn't it?
Well, it provides additional evidence of his identity as one of the two robbers for both of the bank robberies, yes.
And the rule says you've got to decide whether his testimony is necessary.
Well, the rule says essential, which
they've
characterized it as necessary.
And what's the difference between essential and necessary?
Well, our opinion is essential means that it's evidence that relates to a direct issue that's before the court or the jury.
It sounds like you've weakened that to simply we can call a defense attorney anytime his evidence would be helpful.
Why is it essential when it's just about an alibi that he didn't give? I don't understand. So, see, I don't think false alibi or false testimony is good evidence of guilt. As I say, if you think the cards are stacked against you, you may say, well, I'm innocent, but I won't be able to prove it in the usual way, so I better suborn perjury. That's criminal activity, but that doesn't seem to be closely related to the crime for which he's being prosecuted.
Well, I guess we have a difference of opinion. I think false alibi evidence is good evidence. As you pointed out, as to the co-defendant, Mr. Austin's false barbershop alibi was good evidence.
Logic of what I said? What's wrong with that?
Pardon me?
What's wrong with saying that these people are members of the criminal class, right? So suppose this person thinks, look, I'm really behind the eight ball. I have a criminal record. I'm facing a long sentence. I'll probably be convicted. one of these false identification cases. So I think I'll make up a phony alibi. Why would that show he was guilty of the crime? It just show he's a dishonest person, but we knew that anyway.
Well, I mean, it cuts the other way, too, Your Honor. I mean, if the evidence is stacked against you because you did it, then you want to try to find a way out of it.
It can be stacked against you even though you didn't do it, right? You're up against the Justice Department. You're very unlikely to prevail. So.
Well, we believe we followed our ethical obligations and we presented the evidence because it was essential but not necessary for the conviction.
Essential but not necessary. I don't get that either.
Well, I mean, it's essential because it relates to an issue that is being contested at the trial. The fact that there's other evidence from other sources that point to him being the bank robber, for instance, the money in the car.
What was the issue being contested at trial? He wasn't offering an alibi.
The issue was his identity as one of the bank robbers.
No, that's the issue of his guilt. That's not the alibi. He wasn't offering an alibi.
Well, a false alibi...
There was no false alibi in the trial.
Well, the attempt to obtain a false alibi is evidence of his consciousness of guilt.
That had nothing to do with the trial.
I'm sorry?
That had nothing to do with the trial. There was no alibi evidence in the trial for Williams, right?
Correct.
Anything further?
Your Honor, as to whether or not we even get to the discussion of the counsel acted unreasonably, believing that the letter constituted a crime just by the fact that he gave it to him. Our position, our strongest position, I believe, is that it was not a confidential communication in relation to his representation of Mr. Williams. The letter, in the way it was given to Mr. Ryan, was placed in a larger envelope that said legal mail, was mailed to Mr. Ryan with addressed, sealed...
Right. We know it's not a privileged communication seeking advice.
Correct.
But the response to that is that the lawyer's duties of confidentiality and loyalty go considerably beyond the scope of privileged communications. And that's what you need to address.
Okay. Well, the commentary to the rule cited by defendant is that the confidentiality rule, for example, applies not only to matters communicated in confidence by the client, but also to all information relating to the representation, whatever its source. Not just all information, whatever its source, but all information relating to the representation. Mr. Ryan was retained to provide Mr. Williams with assistance in facing these charges of
You're trying to say this was unrelated to the legal representation? It may have been a perversion of the legal representation, attempt to co-opt Ryan into helping him suborn perjury, but surely it's not unrelated.
Well, Mr. Ryan is there to provide him legal advice, represent him in court, make arguments. He's not there to deliver letters that he's not even intended to read to third parties. It did not relate at all to his representation of Mr. Williams. If he wanted to mail a letter to a third party, he had access to mail. He should have just mailed it.
Well, he knew better than that.
Well, but the
so
fact
he
that
was taking advantage of the relationship that he had by reason of Ryan's appointment to represent him. It's all closely related, right?
I disagree. I don't think giving him a letter.
What's your other argument?
Other argument regarding the ineffective assistance
on why. What Ryan did didn't violate duties of confidentiality and loyalty.
Well, we also, our position is that the crime fraud exception applied, that by writing the letter and giving it to Mr. Ryan and tending him.
Okay, it's not the crime fraud exception to the attorney-client privilege.
To the confidentiality rule.
We're talking about the broader duties. Okay.
Right. And by giving him that letter where he outlines the false alibi for his cousin to give to investigators in the court, he's committed a crime.
And if he looks at, he's attempted to commit a crime. If he looks, if the lawyer looks at the rule that authorizes him to disclose, it will tell him in any instance in which the lawyer learns of a client's intention to commit a crime, where practical, the lawyer should seek to persuade the client to take suitable action. In essence, tell him no and talk to him face to face and not immediately turn that information over to the court and to the prosecution. How do you reconcile what Ryan did with the commentary to Rule 1.6 that was in effect that authorized any disclosure?
Well, the crime had already been committed. I know that an attempt to corrupt a witness is a crime. So the crime had been committed when he provided him the letter and wanted him to deliver it to the third party.
Okay. So your theory is that any time a client, regardless of level of sophistication, et cetera, does something this stupid with his lawyer, the lawyer is entitled not to tell him, you're an idiot, forget it, I'm not going to do this, and if you try anything like this, I'm going to have to disclose it to the court, but is required to turn that information over to the prosecutor and the court.
Well, the question is whether or not Attorney Ryan acted unreasonably under all the circumstances. And given the record in this case and his testimony,
that's not an answer to my question.
You said permitted, not required. But the issue isn't whether the lawyer is required to do this, whether he's permitted to, right?
Correct.
And how is he permitted under where the commentary says you've got to talk to your client first?
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Peterson.
You know, I have
Judge Hamilton has rendered you speechless, but okay, Judge Rovner, she's going to try. You know, you bring a speech back. Okay.
Let me lay my hands on your shoulders. I was wondering, I didn't go into it, but if Judge Capella ever said, look, here's why I think a sentence longer than that long sentence originally imposed on the defendants is necessary. Did he ever give reasons for raising the sentence?
Raising the sentence from Judge Reinhardt's sentence? Mm-hmm. He did not give any specific reasons on the record why he decided to give a higher sentence than what Judge Reinhardt had given, but he did give several reasons to support the sentence that he did impose.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Peterson. So, Mr. Nash or Mr. Seneschal, do you have anything further, either of you?
Just to address your question, Judge Posner, about the sentencing differences, the briefs lay out that there were differences between these two defendants that would have justified different sentences. They had different roles in the crime.
But you haven't briefed that.
We raised it in our brief, Your Honor, that they had different roles in the crime and different criminal histories.
Of course you discussed all their different roles, but I thought when you in the very, very brief discussion of vindictiveness and so on, I thought you just had this business about their unique characteristics. I didn't see anything about one should have gotten a higher sentence than the other. It's going to be awkward given that you have one brief for both of them. But, right, is there anything? Am I missing something?
I believe that we raised it in the statement of facts as well to describe the
when you're just talking about the sentences, are you saying, did you say anything about why they should have gotten different sentences? Is there anything there? I don't see anything.
I'm not sure, Your Honor, but what we said in the statement of facts was that they had different characteristics.
No, but when you're arguing that the sentence is improper, you have to explain why you think the characteristics of the defendants would lead to different sentences. They could They could be very different, but the sentences could be the same. See, the problem is the only basis for different sentences is different culpability. And you don't, in your joint brief, you don't want to argue that one of the defendants was less culpable than the other.
That's true, Your Honor, but the fact remains there is differences.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much to Mr. Seneschal, Mr. Nash. And you were appointed, were you not?
Yes.
So we thank you very much for your efforts on behalf of your clients, and we thank